From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very thankful for that support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, March 6th is Orthodox Christian Sunday. Tuesday brings the observance of Maha Shivaratri, and the Baha'i 19-day fast continues until March 20th. Now, at the intersection of religion, government, and politics, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments this week on the biggest abortion case in 20 years. The issue is whether severe restrictions in Texas are medically necessary or a deliberate attempt to impede access to a constitutionally protected procedure. Notably, the three female justices were unusually forceful and united in challenging the state's arguments. The position of the Roman Catholic Archbishop of St. Louis regarding the Girl Scouts seems to carry a lot of weight, or at least is likely to cause some weight gain. The week after, Robert Carlson trashed the organization for being, quote, incompatible with Catholic teachings, the Eastern Missouri branch broke all records for Girl Scout cookie sales. Russell Moore, president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention, is no longer describing himself as an evangelical. As he wrote in the Washington Post, it's a response to fellow evangelicals supporting Donald Trump for president in what Moore sees as an abandonment of evangelical values. And in Russia, an atheist is facing a year in prison for denying the existence of God on Facebook. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
So you have all these conservatives out there who feel we elect our guys, and then they don't get done the things that they said they get done. And I think that gives us this campaign where Donald Trump and Ted Cruz are the two leading candidates in the primary.
E.J. Dionne is a journalist and author, an educator, and an insightful commentator and keen observer of our politics and culture. Earlier this year, E.J. published his latest book titled Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. It's a thorough and thoughtful look at both the history and the consequences of the conservative movement in this country. And I'm looking forward to welcoming the author back to the show later in the hour.
Evangelical voters are more complex than people give them credit to. They don't vote just for who goes to church on Sunday. They vote for someone who they feel confident will lead this nation forward.
Much has been made of the evangelical vote in this campaign season. But the idea that there is a Bible-based block of voters focusing on restoring moral virtue to our nation is as inaccurate as it is naive. In truth, the values voter concept was born of a desire for political power, which then perfected its appeal to this audience, not the opposite. We'll explore where this has now brought us when I'm joined once again by Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance. But first,
this little guy has lied so much about my record.
There we go. The person.
Don't worry about it, little Marco. I will.
All right. Well, let's hear big Don.
Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it, little Marco.
Gentlemen.
On Tuesday, a significant number of voters got to have their say. And back with us to help figure out what they actually said is Greg LaBelle, who teaches political management at George Washington University. Greg's also worked inside several presidential campaigns. Greg, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
It's nice to continue on this journey with you, Welton.
Would you start today with a quick lesson on why Super Tuesday is so important in this election cycle?
Well, Super Tuesday is important because there are so many delegates at stake on Super Tuesday. This is the first time that we've had a majority of folks from the South, which is how Super Tuesday came into existence originally back in the 80s. Southern states were saying, you know, Iowa, New Hampshire are having all this to say about what goes on. How about if a bunch of us Southern states get together and we'll hold our primaries and caucuses on the same day so that we can have some influence on this thing before it's too late? There were a great number of delegates that were up for grabs on both sides on Tuesday, and so it becomes a very important day.
Would you tell us, Greg, what you consider the most important takeaways from the voting this past week?
On the Democratic side, I think we saw Hillary Clinton find her groove, and I think it's really started in Nevada. I listened to her acceptance speech in Nevada and found myself talking to the TV, as I often do during these things, and letting her know that she seemed to have finally figured out how to do this, how to talk. She moved the focus of her speech from herself to the voters. And I think that was a significant adjustment for her, which is very important. Instead of talking about me and why I'm qualified to be president, she started talking about her voters about why this is important to you. And I think both the substance and the delivery of that speech really sort of set the tone going into Super Tuesday. And in Super Tuesday, she did extremely well. Mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders took Vermont, not surprisingly, it's where he's from, took Minnesota, Oklahoma, and Colorado. But Clinton, primarily by appealing very strongly to African-American voters in those Southern states, did extremely well, and put herself in a pretty strong position, maybe an unbeatable position, I think, at this point toward the nomination. It's hard to see how Sanders can come back at this point and take the lead. On the Republican side, we have a very different story. In addition to the states that Donald Trump won, and there were many, I think the best news for Donald Trump is nobody dropped out. As long as there are at least three or four people who are competing as the anti-Trump candidates, that anti-Trump vote continues to be split up among those folks, so he continues to win and he continues to collect delegates. I think if there's anything that's helping Donald Trump move inexorably toward the nomination right now, it's probably that.
So if you were a Republican political consultant, would you be stressing that some people need to get out of the way?
If I were a smart Republican consultant, I probably would have been doing that no more recently than a month ago. The big question now is whether it's too late. Cruz and Rubio in particular are sort of changing their tones. Rubio especially is changing his tone in this campaign, and I'm not sure that it, in the long run, it will work to his favor. But everyone was so afraid of Donald Trump for so long to attack him that they allowed him to sort of develop this persona and this backing and racking up these wins. The big question now is it in fact inevitable? And I suspect it's probably very close to inevitable that he'll be the nominee, unless the Republican Party leadership steps in and tries to take it away from him.
You know, one of the surprises for me is the late appearance of Republican Party leaders, the so-called establishment.
There was a great deal of denial going on for a long time in the party. No one really believed that Donald Trump could actually be a serious candidate, could actually win primary, and certainly couldn't find himself as the front runner and the leader in delegates at this point. And they've been proven wrong. And so all of a sudden, everyone in the Republican Party sort of look at each other and say, what do we do? And it's interesting because there's two things that are happening now. We see some Republicans going so far, and these are elected members of Congress, who are saying, I will not vote for Donald Trump if he's the nominee, and some sort of variations around that theme. And then on the other side, you have Republicans who are starting to say, you know, he's probably going to be our nominee, and we need to get behind him. So there are, once again, sort of two tracks in the Republican Party who are on opposite sides of each other as to how they go forward. And this is going to be a tough one for them to work out. I suspect that the folks who are saying, you know, Trump's going to be okay, he's not going to be the worst thing to happen to the party, we can get behind him, and so on and so forth, are probably more addressing that to the people who they need to fund, not their presidential race, but their Senate races in particular. They're trying to calm the fears of the money people who are going to be providing money to their Senate candidates. They don't want to spook these folks, and I think that's at least a part of the message that's going out on that side of the argument. But I think in general, Republicans are pretty concerned about the fact that Donald Trump might be their nominee.
You know, Marco Rubio arrived on the scene as a Tea Party favorite. Now he seems to be the establishment standard bearer somehow. Why and how?
Yeah, you know, Welton, I've been asking everybody that question myself. You're right. I mean, he came in to the Senate as the darling of the Tea Party, and I guess it's a testament to how Donald Trump has driven the debate in the Republican race for the nomination to the point that all of a sudden we look at Marco Rubio as the mainstream guy, as the establishment guy. It's quite remarkable how that's happened, because he really hasn't changed his positions on any issues. I think part of it, too, is comparative. I mean, we obviously look at Donald Trump, but then we look at Ted Cruz, who's the other guy at the top of the heap. And I think that there is, if not as much, close to as much concern about Ted Cruz being the nominee as Donald Trump. So that leaves Marco Rubio as the guy to sort of carry the banner for what we would call mainstream Republicans. I think John Kasich, had he done better, had he been able to establish himself more strongly as a candidate, might have filled that role. But try as he might, I think Kasich just is obviously having trouble doing that.
After watching what happened in Texas, can we anticipate Trump coming back even harder now on Cruz?
I was a little surprised at how the media was sort of building up the fact that Ted Cruz won Texas. Mm-hmm. He's from Texas. I think it would have been a huge story if he had lost Texas, but he won Texas with 44% of the vote. That's not exactly a blowout for a guy in his own home state. Mm-hmm. I think Donald Trump is sort of trying to gauge how to deal with these two guys. And again, Trump is smart enough to know at this point, it's a little too early to try to drive one of them out of the race. Again, he needs that anti-Trump vote to be split up among two or three other candidates, because it allows him to keep racking up wins. I mean, you look at Super Tuesday. He won with 43% in Alabama, 33% in Arkansas, 39% in Tennessee, 33% in Vermont. These were winning numbers for him. If the anti-Trump vote had fallen to one other candidate, he may not have won those states.
Mm-hmm. Greg, there's a lot of passion among Democratic Party voters, whether they support Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
How will the winning campaign be able to bring the other candidate supporters over to their side once all has been said and done?
I think it's going to be easier on the Democratic side than on the Republican side. I say that in part because I sense that Hillary Clinton is already starting to do that. Mm-hmm. And there are two reasons for this. She started to turn her attention to the Republican nominee, probably Trump, in her stump speech and sort of talking about this is where we need to go. I thought her line that she started using in Nevada and has used since then, that we don't need to make America great again, America's already great. What we need to do is make America whole again.
Yeah.
That's a very strong statement, and obviously it's directed specifically at Donald Trump as the presumptive Republican nominee. So she's stepping back a little bit from attacking Bernie Sanders. I think he has, to his credit, gotten her to talk a little bit more about some of the issues that he cares about. So I think we're going to see a gradual sort of melding of that. I don't think Bernie's going to drop out anytime soon. He doesn't need to. He's got lots of money, so he can stay in. But I think Bernie's smart enough to realize that what it's about now is really trying to make sure that his agenda is part of the Democratic agenda in the fall. So there's no reason to think that these two won't work it out between them. In terms of voters, it's a different question. A lot of the folks who have been supporting Bernie Sanders are driven, I want to make sure I don't overstate this or misstate it, but they're driven by the same kind of anxiety and frustration from the left that a lot of the Trump voters are dealing with on the right. Now, obviously, the solutions that they see and the people who carry the banner of that frustration are very, very different people between Trump and Sanders. But there is that level of frustration. And there are a lot of young people, young idealistic people. What we don't know is whether these young idealistic people, if they see their guy not win the nomination, whether they say, okay, I'm going home now, that didn't work out and I'm done, or whether they sort of move toward Clinton. And part of that is an organizational question. It's not a philosophical question. It's an organizational question. Because what made Barack Obama so successful with young people and previously disenfranchised people was not just his message, but the organization that he had built that ensured that many of them went to the polls. Mm-hmm. I don't think we know how that part of it's all going to play out just yet. So that's a big kind of open question right now.
Greg LaBelle is Assistant Professor of Political Management at George Washington University, where he's the Director of the Semester in Washington Politics Program, a veteran of several presidential campaigns. Over the years, Greg has also served in several leadership roles at Interfaith Alliance, And I'm always grateful that we can turn to him for insights and analysis. Greg, thanks as always for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Elton. Stay tuned. I'm sure there'll be a surprise down the road very soon.
It's easy to be a fan of Washington Post columnist E.J. Dionne. While he pulls no punches in his commentary on our political culture, E.J. never sinks to the kind of personal attacks that have sadly become almost unavoidable in today's public discourse. Instead, his insights come with a refreshing dose of empathy, even as his observations of the state of our politics and our society are both incisive and instructive. In January, E.J. published his latest book titled Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond, and I am delighted that it brings E.J. Dionne back to State of Belief Radio today. E.J., welcome back to the show.
It is a joy to be with you always. Thanks so much for having me on.
In this book, I find some comfort in the kinds of shakeups the American right has been dealing with, at least back as far as Barry Goldwater. So, E.J., do you see this year as less unprecedented than some others think it is?
Well, I think in some ways it's unprecedented just because it's hard to imagine a presidential candidate quite like Donald Trump. And it's hard to imagine so many very raw issues coming to the surface as they have in this election. But what I argue in the book is that this has been a long time coming, and that if no one predicted Trump, everything that's happened is a logical consequence of things that came before. You know, the core argument of my book is, the first sentence of the book is, the history of contemporary American conservatism is the story of disappointment and betrayal. Mm-hmm. And I argue that ever since Goldwater's campaign in 1964, conservative politicians have had to make a series of promises that they couldn't keep. Promises about reducing the size of government, for example, where no president since Goldwater, no Republican president, not Nixon, not Reagan, or either Bush, have been able to reduce the size of government. It was the same size when Reagan left office as when he took office. And one of the reasons is that Americans may be quite critical of government in the abstract and unhappy with certain ways it performs, but they actually want government to do and achieve a lot of things. And that even includes Tea Partiers. As I point out in the book, a lot of Tea Partiers say, oh, we don't want to cut Social Security and Medicare. And they argue, well, these are earned benefits, but it's no accident that, you know, a very large percentage of Tea Partiers are near, at, or over the age of 65. They don't want these programs gotten rid of. And you can think of that down a long list. There's been a promise to roll back the cultural change that we've seen in our country over the last 50 years. Well, most Americans don't want to go backwards. Mm-hmm. And then of late, there has been an implicit, and in Donald Trump's case, an explicit promise with the deportations he's talking about to change the ethnic makeup of the country back to where it might have been in 1940. And none of these promises can be kept. And so there's been a real rage on the right at the failure of their own side to achieve what they promised. That's one source of Trumpism. The second source is that a lot of white working class voters have voted Republican for decades and have nothing to show for it materially. And that's not just a liberal like me talking. In the book, I spent a lot of time talking to conservatives before I even put any pen to paper. And also, I've read a lot of conservative writing. And people like Ross Douthat, the columnist for The New York Times, or Raihan Salam and others, have warned the party that we got all these working class supporters and we better start delivering to them. And Donald Trump is in some ways the revenge of those voters on the party. His support is disproportionately from less affluent Republicans. And so these are just a couple of the forces I identify in the book that I think lead us to where we are today.
You write with a lot of facts, obviously, and a lot of historical data. but you also write with empathy. And one of the strange reactions I had in reading your book was I thought, if I had been a right-wing conservative for all of these years, I'd be mad too.
I think that's right. And I think the Republican leadership has kind of played fast and loose with this following. They've been willing to gin up an awful lot of anger, hoping they could then corral it and contain it. And now they've discovered they can't. The line that's been coming to me a lot in the last several months is from John F. Kennedy's inaugural address, where Kennedy said, he who foolishly rides to power by riding the back of the tiger ends up inside. And I think what you've got is a Republican establishment that has ended up inside the tiger that they've been riding. And Mitt Romney giving a very strong anti-Trump speech, and there's quite a bit of what he said that I agree with. But if you go back to the 2012 campaign, he welcomed Donald Trump's endorsement. It didn't matter to him that Donald Trump had been a birther or had said all kinds of extraordinary things. He praised on Trump. And so the party that, you know, is, in biblical terms, it's kind of reaping what it sowed here. I really appreciate what you say about empathy, because I tried really hard in the book to say that I don't come at conservatism as some anthropologist approaching some strange tribe. I point out that I grew up in a conservative family. I have literally loved conservatives in my life, so I don't view conservatives as some strange species. I started around age 13 to having doubts about what conservatives thought, and I ended up where I am now. But I do think that, you know, we need a sensible conservatism as part of our polity, which is why this kind of radical right makes me so uneasy. There's a friend of mine called Jim Kloppenberg, who teaches up at Harvard, who has a very interesting book coming out in a few months about democracy. And at the end of the book, he sort of quotes St. Paul to talk about what the democratic spirit ought to be like. How should we approach debate? And it's St. Paul's line about we need to see through each other's eyes and think through each other's minds. Now, I'm sure I fail at that often, but I do think it's a useful aspiration for all of us to have. And I try at least occasionally in the book to live up to it.
Is there a period in our history that you would say closely resembles the forces driving today's campaigns?
Well, I hate to say it, but some of the period that I think of a lot is the period right before our Civil War, where there was very much this kind of hatred. I mean, you had literally attacks on the floor of Congress. You had Supreme Court decisions like Dred Scott. You had just profound disagreements with the court. You had that kind of feeling. I also think you saw some of this at the end of the Gilded Age, you know, or in the middle of the Gilded Age, with some of the fights over the kind of economic change we were having in the country. And if there's one useful thing that can come from the Trump rebellion, and in a very different way, it's a useful thing that can come from the Bernie Sanders rebellion. I don't think these are similar, but they do each speak to something very important in the country, which is there are an awful lot of people whose lives have been turned upside down and not in a good way by the forces of technological change and globalization. And there are a lot of people whose incomes have collapsed, who work really hard and don't have a lot to show for it. And I think both parties need to pay a lot of attention to that anger. And it gets expressed in all kinds of ways, and sometimes in ways that can be ugly. But the anger itself comes from a set of discontents that I think all of us should take seriously. Peggy Noonan, whom I often disagree with, had an interesting way to put it in the Wall Street Journal recently, where she said, in some ways, this is a fight between the protected and the unprotected. And paradoxically, even though they might end up on very different sides of politics, white working class Americans who've been hammered and African Americans in our cities who are very upset both about discrimination, what's happening on the streets, the killings that have happened that are unjustified, there is something in common in their anger at the system, and we need politicians who can try to pull those people together and approach our discontents in a more constructive way.
What parallels did you see between Goldwater and the Tea Party?
Goldwater really set off both the purge of the Republican Party, the elimination first of all liberals and then of most moderates, and also set off a retreat from the Republican Party of an awful lot of first liberal and then moderate Republicans. And if you go back to Goldwater's book, The Conscience of a Conservative, published in 1960, and by the way, helpfully republished recently by Princeton University Press, it's really worth looking at, because if you cut out the part about the Soviet Union, which is dated, it reads exactly like a Tea Party book, and I sort of analyze it that way. Now, we look back fondly at Goldwater and even people on the left side of politics because he was a good and decent man. He later, as you know, became impatient with the religious right and became somewhat more moderate himself. I discovered a moment in the 96 campaign that I hadn't remembered, when Pat Buchanan actually was challenging Bob Dole. Dole wanted Goldwater's blessing to show he's a true conservative, so he troops out to Arizona. Goldwater certifies him as a true conservative, and then Bob Dole just can't stay on message, which is one of the things that's lovable about him and honest. He says, you know, Barry, we're the liberals now. And Goldwater says, yeah, we are the liberals. But if you go back to the Goldwater of 64, this is a very hard Social Security, as fundamentally a socialist program, no farm program, cutting back the size of government. And so Goldwater really set the party on a path that it's been on all these years. And in many ways, the Tea Party is only going back to original Goldwaterism. I guess they are originalists in more ways than one.
Why do you describe devotion to Ronald Reagan as a core problem for modern conservatism?
Well, the chapter on Reagan, as you know, is called The Ambiguous Hero. Mm-hmm. And one of the conservatives I talked to before I started writing the book was Charles Krauthammer, my colleague, the columnist. We disagree most of the time, but we have friendly relations. And he said the perfect thing I thought about Reagan, which is you can choose your Reagan. And that on the one hand, folks on the right of the party who look to Reagan as a hero have a right to do that, because the Reagan who spoke on behalf of Barry Goldwater in 1964 and who laid out a whole series of positions on the right end of the spectrum really was a hard movement conservative. He was against Medicare. He didn't like Social Security. And the list was very long. Yet when Reagan governed, he often was lucky enough to govern with Democrats, and together they produced a far more moderate program. And Reagan was willing to do things that conservatives would not permit anybody else to do. He raised taxes a number of times. It may have been Reagan, the peace-minded Reagan, not just Reagan the warrior, who helped bring about a successful end of the Cold War, because under a lot of conservative attack, he said Gorbachev is for real, and he was right about that. And I have a long list of his apostasies where, you know, liberals argue that he wouldn't fit easily in the Republican Party of today. Mm-hmm. And so I think Reagan is let off the hook by a lot of people on the right, A, because they see him as successful, B, because they sort of can say that most of his apostasies he really didn't want to do, but he kind of had to do. And the other argument I make is, if I can invoke religious language, George H.W. Bush kind of politically died for Reagan's sins, which is they held against the first President Bush the things they didn't hold against Reagan, notably Bush's decision to sign a tax increase. It was okay when Reagan did it. It was no longer okay when George H.W. Bush did it.
I'm very impressed by the point that you make about the importance of a responsible conservative movement in our nation and how all of us can benefit from that. People would not expect a typical liberal to say that. You make that point strongly.
I know. Could I just say, that is so sweet of you. Could I just say one quick thing before we close? In my book, Dwight Eisenhower is a kind of hero, with apologies to all of those folks out there who may have supported Adlai Stevenson against Ike. But I think Ike really does represent the kind of conservatism that was very constructive in our history. And he really was a conservative. He was a budget balancer. He was pro-business. He was very sympathetic to religion. But he also saw a constructive role for government. Two of the big Ike programs, the Interstate Highway System, which is one of the big public works projects, maybe the biggest in our history, and the Federal Student Loan Program, which helped millions of people, including me, go to college. And there's an Ike quote that I commend to my friends on the right. Ike once said, "Neither a wise man nor a brave man lies down on the tracks of history to wait for the train of the future to run over him." I think conservatives should think about that, and I think they should be more optimistic, actually, about the state of the country than they are right now. We have a lot of problems and the capacity to solve them. As Sarah Palin, if I can invoke Sarah Palin, they need a bit more of the hopey changey thing right now.
Oh, my. The Bible and Sarah Palin, both, you quote. look, I just one more question, and I know we're over time. I want to know, what did writing this book do to you? What happened inside E.J. Dionne?
You know, I think a couple of things. I really appreciated the conservatives who sat down with me, some of whom I had known for a long time, people like Mike Gerson, President Bush's speechwriter, or somebody like Tom Davis, the Republican congressman from Virginia, but some people who really didn't know me, including a couple of Tea Party congressmen, Mick Mulvaney and Raul Labrador. And I was really, in a way, even though they weren't going to convert me, we did have some real disagreements, but it was a very powerful thing that it was possible for people who disagreed fundamentally to sit down and compare notes about the state of the country. And I very much appreciated that they were willing to do that, knowing I was working on a book that was going to be critical of the contemporary right. A second thing is, I did have some hope that I do think there are quite a few Republicans and conservatives out there who know that they need to change the direction of the movement. Not as much, you know, some of my conservative friends joke with me that I wouldn't be happy until they became liberals or social Democrats, and maybe there's some truth to that, but they have an intimation that something is wrong and they have to move in a different direction. And so that experience of dialogue persuaded me that at least in principle, we ought to be able to have a bit more of that in our politics. And so I think that those were kind of two things that came out of it for me that made the experience itself, putting aside the writing and the rewriting and trying to also stay up to events, those were probably two of the most important things out of the experience.
E.J. Dionne is a leading journalist and political commentator and a longtime op-ed columnist for The Washington Post. E.J.
And a longtime friend of yours.
Well, thank you, man. E.J. is a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and a university professor in the Foundations of Democracy and Culture at the McCourt School of Public Policy. E.J.'s books are reliable. They are valuable, and his latest is no exception. It's titled Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. E.J., I can't tell you how much I appreciate you taking time to be with us today on this show, State of Belief Radio.
Well, I so appreciate that. Thank you so much.
As various presidential candidates tussle over voters who are driven by their religious beliefs, it's not always obvious that that's what's happening. For a look at the way real and perceived religious teachings are influencing the current campaign for the White House, I'm joined once again by Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance. Jack, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Elton.
How tightly do you think are conservative religious beliefs bound to the general nostalgia for the good old days that is such a force in this year's campaign?
What I've been pondering, and I don't have a good answer to, is whether people want to go back to a place where they can cling to those values with all the positives and negatives that come along with them, or whether they've abandoned those values because they think they didn't serve them well, and therefore we've wound up in the situation we're in. But either way, people have a yearning to go back where they were rather than progressing forward to where we might be.
Jack, is this nostalgia evident among Jewish voters and non-religious voters that you know of?
I've heard more than one of my rabbinic colleagues talk about this urge in biblical terms. They bring to mind the rebellion of the Israelites against Moses, both the one that's described in the book of Exodus and the one in the book of Numbers, where they have a nostalgic view of what life was like in Egypt, even though that view isn't accurate at all. They talk about the flesh pots of Egypt and the cucumbers and melons they ate in abundance. And even in the rebellion of Korach and Dathan and Abiram, the accusation that's made of Moses is that you've taken us out into the wilderness to be slaves. Let's go back to Egypt where we were free men. And that's the kind of language I'm hearing now of people who are applauding this sense that we need to take America back to where it once was.
Yeah. The statement from the Southern Baptist Convention's Russell Moore this past week was a surprise to many when he basically declared that the word evangelical has lost its relevance because of the number of conservative Christians flocking to Donald Trump. I know very well how taking a more progressive stand on social issues can get a person accused of not being an evangelical Christian, but this is an entirely different approach. It really grabbed my attention.
So I'm interested, Welton, because after all, I'm a rabbi and have spent not a lot of time in the chair that you occupied for so many years. What do you think about that? I mean, you've struggled with this word evangelical, both with a lowercase e and a capital E. Is there really an evangelical Christianity at work here, or does it seem to you like people have been pretending all along?
You know, Jack, I have always understood the word evangelical to be a religious term. Evangelical basically means a bearer of good news, someone who has a message of good news to share. In the religious traditions, that was the basic concept. And so I have always thought that the evangelical community was much broader than most people thought. It was not a homogeneous community at all. It was a community held together by a commitment to sharing a story that was called good news, but within that was a whole lot of diversity. And I, as early as the 70s, was arguing that people were trying to put a stereotype on individuals who call themselves evangelicals. What happened was, in my opinion, the word evangelical was stolen by the religious right and then ultimately turned into a political term by media people in the most part. What happened was that the whole idea of evangelical as a bearer of good news was taken away and then identified. And I've always thought this was one of the very worst consequences of the religious right's work. They took a good religious concept and vocabulary and they stole it for purposes of political partisanship. And that made it much easier for pollsters to do their work, because all they had to do then was say, well, okay, this is the evangelical vote. And so what it meant to be an evangelical after that kind of transition took place was you had to be against abortion, against gay marriage, for giving public money to private schools, interpreting the scriptures literally, and not having a place at the table of the religious table for women. So you took a concept that was a positive one in the religious community and turned it into a redefined concept in the political community, and that robbed it of all its religious integrity, as I see it.
And I think we've seen something similar happening in a parallel track to the terms religious liberty and religious freedom.
Mm-hmm.
They've been acquired by a particular political perspective, and there's been an attempt to legislate them in the name of a very conservative right-wing approach to religion to justify a certain amount of discrimination that religious liberty, religious freedom, and the legislation attached to them was meant to prevent. So I hear what you're saying about the nature of redefining a religious term. But I would think, Welton, that even those people who consider themselves progressive evangelicals, and I've met many of them, people who share your definition of the word, nonetheless holds to certain values that I think you and I would probably agree on. Things like marital fidelity, a commitment to telling the truth, a personal relationship with God that is not simply one that is a matter of rhetorical expression, but is reflected in the way your speech is conducted, your activities are conducted, your business is conducted. And yet we see evangelicals flocking behind candidates, and I want to make sure you hear that there's an S on the end of that word, who don't represent those values. What has happened to the influence of, in the case of evangelical Christians, what's happened to the influence of Christianity on evangelicals?
Well, I honestly do think that both from conservative Christianity to fundamentalist Christianity, the term has almost been stolen completely. The religious rights strategy in this nation has always been first to steal people's language. And if you can steal their language, then you can redefine the most critical terms. And that gives then permission and an opportunity to speak about partisan political issues using the tone of religion itself. And I thought one of the most remarkable statements in Russell Moore's opinion editorial was his confession, which I have waited 20 years to hear someone in that community say, his confession that those who had charged the religious right with using religious language for political purposes, he said, that's right. We might as well admit that's what's happened. I think that is a great step forward, and I hope as we see religious language prostituted for political purposes in this campaign, I hope people realize that what the people who do that are talking about is not a religious conviction. It is about a political persuasion. And that makes me then want to ask you, what kinds of responsibility can be avoided if certain campaign issues are perennially couched in religious language?
You know that we have a broader view of this than just what's going on in the evangelical Christian community. That kind of language has been hijacked in certain Jewish circles. We see the debates going on a little less in the public eye in the Muslim community about how to use these religious terms. And we see people who lay no particular claim to a particular approach or denomination of religion, acquiring that language in the hopes of currying favor with constituent groups. My hopes are buoyed by political leaders, good people on both sides of the aisle, who are not embarrassed to express what their personal commitments might be in terms of ethics and values, but who nonetheless insist that A, they have to follow the law, and B, if they want to change the law, they have to make a case that is based on constitutional principles and not theocratic principles. And that's what we're trying to do here at Interfaith Alliance. It's what you're trying to do on State of Belief Radio, is to promote a notion that the Constitution is what binds us together, and religion is what gives us our nuance in how we interpret it.
Neither you nor I has any interest in challenging the way individual Americans interpret their own faith traditions, doctrines. But we are both concerned about the identification of religion with very partisan political initiatives that end up dividing people, excluding people, instead of helping bring a nation together so that we can be faithful to the kind of democracy that's envisioned in our Constitution.
I think it's even more critical than that. You've been a pastor for most of your adult life. I've been a rabbi for most of my adult life. And much of what we do is aimed at entrusting a tradition to another generation. And you've discussed on this program before, and I know it well, that the largest growing religious cohort in America, particularly among younger people, is those who profess no particular religion whatsoever. They may consider themselves spiritual, they may consider themselves religious with a small r, but they're not affiliating and they're not subscribing to any particular approach to religious faith and practice. Now, I honor that, I respect it, and I embrace it. But what it means is that the divide between those people who are continuing to play on yesterday's construct of religious life and those who are going to lead this country forward in the future, that gap is widening. And it frightens me for exactly those reasons, Welton, that when it comes to the point where the majority of this country is unwilling to declare an allegiance to a particular religious tradition, and I say that with a completely neutral tone, I worry what's going to happen to freedom of religion, genuine freedom of religion, for those people who still want to declare that allegiance. It's in the Bible, too, I have to tell you. Moses said there was a generation that had to come to an end before there was a next generation willing to lead them forward into the fulfillment of promises. But it was done with respect, and it was done with embrace.
Jack, almost in every time we get together for a conversation on the air, I am committed to asking you a question that I always wanted other interviewers to ask me. So talk about, if you will, the practices Interfaith Alliance is working on right now to address the kind of challenges that you and I have just discussed.
So we've come to understand, Welton, that it isn't simply enough for us to be reactive to the outrageous violations of our sensibilities that we read about in the paper and that we see on television and that we pick up in social media. We don't live in a time in which we can afford to be passive and reactive. We have begun a campaign that I think our members and our supporters are going to see very soon, asking people to take proactive steps, like engaging candidates with questions about faith and freedom when they encounter them. We are not going to wait until the news cycle comes around and invites us to comment on what freedom of religion, freedom of faith really means. We have a proactive message that we're sending out. I would love to be more specific. It's getting ready to come out, and I don't want to make a representation that isn't going to be accurate.
I presume that you don't always have the amount of money you need to do that work. Would that be an accurate statement?
We don't always have the amount of money we need, Welton. And that's absolutely an accurate statement. And I appreciate your suggesting an opportunity for me to encourage our listeners to be supportive of Interfaith Alliance. I write a small blog for people who have been students of mine during my years as a rabbi. And I wrote this week about the abundance of contributions that were made to the construction of the tabernacle. and how at one point the project managers of the tabernacle asked people to stop contributing because they simply had more than they needed to complete the task at hand. And I connected that to people who were extremely wealthy in this country who seemed to be willing to pour millions and perhaps in the aggregate billions of dollars into campaigns to promote candidates who don't, in my opinion, represent what genuine American values were, on the notion that these candidates will do the best to cure the social ills in our country. If the monies that were devoted to campaigning were devoted to doing the right thing, and I would include Interfaith Alliance's work in that, but I would also include feeding the hungry and clothing those who are unable to afford their proper raiment and those who don't have shelter, if that money were diverted to where it could actually do some good, promoting civic values and alleviating the pain and suffering of people around us, it would make some of these elections much less necessary.
Rabbi Jack Moline is president of Interfaith Alliance. With many years of congregational leadership and interreligious activism on his resume, Jack is a prominent advocate for constitutionally based religious freedom in this country. Jack, as always, thanks for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
And Welton, thank you for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. We count on people making donations to State of Belief Radio because we believe, as you believe, this ought to be on the air, available for all people who are thinkers and patriots. If you've heard anything on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, I hope you will share it with them. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. The community that has grown around State of Belief Radio is active all week long online. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. Could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.